Hey everybody, quick note on this episode. It's another one we recorded at Worldcon. We started recording outside, but then we had to go inside because of airplane noises and lorries making beeps. I've got most of that stuff out, but there is going to be a moment in the middle where I'm going to make a note that we kind of jump forward without a thought being completed, and we kind of try to rehash it, but that doesn't quite gel together, so I just made that note there. Otherwise, the audio is good. Surprisingly, you'll just notice that the location obviously changes because one section is more cavernous than the other. So, on that note, I'm just going to shut up and let you guys enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3... 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy Fanny Show. I'm Sean. I'm here with Chuck Gannon. Hello.
Hello.
So, really quick, you were nominated for some sort of an award.
A little known, obscure one called the Nebula, which I lost to the best possible competition in the world, as proven by last night's results and Lecky.
Yeah.
Winning for Ancillary Justice, which I think is a wonderful novel. And what I was really pleased to see, quite frankly, with this victory is that, to me, it was a shoe-in for the Nebula. I mean, I went to the Nebula knowing I didn't have to get nervous because Anne Leckie was going to win, which I told her, as a matter of fact, beforehand. It's a big idea book. It is a fun book. It is a book with immense contemporary relevance without it seeming some... You know, some things take a sort of almost demagogic or pedantic approach of trying to almost fit themselves to the issues du jour, as the case may be. I didn't feel that in her book. Her book just happened to be about things that were about issues that are very much at the forefront of our consciousness right now and evolving zeitgeist, if you will. And so when she won for that, I was absolutely not surprised that was going to be a Nebula Award winner. So what was nice to see, quite frankly, was that it was also a Hugo winner, particularly against, you know, there was a very august series against which it was competing, and I think had largely been dismissed. And I wouldn't say that I had dismissed it, but I really did feel that at the very best, this was a David and Goliath moment. And lo and behold, David or, you know,
Goliath, Davina, depending on your perspective.
Well, yeah, it depends on how you're measuring it. But the, quote, the little book did, in the sense that it is a, while it is a big book, it is one book versus, you know, essentially an incredible arc of work.
Yeah.
So it was nice to see that win. And of course, Anne cleaned up everything. Well, there is one exception. Fire with Fire did win the Compton Crook Award.
there you go.
So that was, it was, you know, that's kind of nice too. But to be on the Nebula slate with the folks who were on it, it was just an immense honor.
Yeah, and it's certainly that doesn't happen to everyone. So the idea that you got up there is really actually quite awesome.
It was a pleasure to me. It was also kind of a surprise. I was in New York with my wife. She was there on business. We were going to turn it. We have four kids, so we were going to turn that into an extra day and a slightly long weekend, which never happens. And I went online to SFWA, and I saw somebody saying, well, two people on Facebook said, geez, you know, I just nominated Chuck Gannon. And I'm sitting there saying, what? Because I really did not expect Fire with Fire to necessarily garner, at the very most, you know, penny anti-partisan sort of stuff, just folks who know me. But it turned out to be a lot more than that. When I went on, I think there were already 10, 12 nomination votes in the first round. And I was like, okay, so this is a good thing. So that was a very, very pleasant surprise. And I was, you know, just delighted to be there. And one of the things that I found really interesting, but was really not surprised at, is that You know, sometimes I think that it's the folks who are most, who are very often peripherally connected to the awards process and things like that, who are all ramped up about the, quote, politicization and polarization of it. I find, and maybe just because I'm dense, is that the folks who are in it are just pleased to be with the people in it. I mean, we all bring different things to it. I don't think you could point at any two books, for instance, on the Nebula Slate and say, oh, those are two very much cut from the same cloth. They're not.
That's a fair point.
And the authorial interests and strengths and choices that are being made. My attitude, both as a writer and as a professor for a number of years, is I came to a class saying I'm going to learn as much, certainly, as I'm going to teach, because everybody else is seeing the world differently, but they're sharing that world with me, and I have something very important to gain from that. I have a tendency to think that at least the majority, and possibly the great majority, if not all, of the contestants that I was sitting alongside this year, you know, the bottom line is these are people respecting each other's craft. We come at the craft from different perspectives, with different objectives, perhaps, but, you know, what I'll say is this. They say, okay, the Yugos are a popularity contest. It's a pop. Okay, maybe there's some truth to that. But I think it's also truth to say there are so many of us working that, with the possible exception of myself, only the good ones are going to get there anyhow. So even if there is a popularity component, that really doesn't speak to the issue of is there not also, therefore, a qualitative component. There still is. And that both might be present. Well, that's the nature of horse racing. That's the nature of, I think, any enterprise, whether you want to call it more to the art side or the entertainment side.
Sure.
It's going to have that diversity.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing about the Hugo is, it is on the one hand a popularity contest, but on the other hand, there are a couple things on the ballot that, I'll be honest, I did not think were very good and didn't really deserve to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But just based on the quality of the work, they didn't win.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of them was dead last.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know the rankings myself.
I imagine you could guess who was
dead last. I probably
wouldn't
be surprised.
I don't know if the vote was largely on the quality. Mm-hmm. There may have been a lot of political things based on that individual, which you could probably guess.
Yeah. No surprises.
But that said, that particular individual, their story was not, I did not think it was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the political nature, by comparison to what else was on the ballot, there was no way I was ever going to vote for that.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't do it. So I do think quality has to come into it. I think it's the nature, the level to which the politics affects our assessment of quality, which is actually a more interesting question, I think. Because our politics affects, like, whatever our politics are in the most general sense, it does affect how we perceive things around us.
Possibly. I'm not sure. Well, let's put it like this. To a measure, I would agree that that's absolutely true. I think there's probably a fair degree of... that's a spectrum with a lot of different shades on it.
Sure.
Without getting into any names and allowing everybody to fill in their own blanks here.
Sure.
Also, not having been a Hugo finalist ever, I don't say that I would actively aspire to it, but it sure would be nice. I'll also say that I really would not want to claim the kind of insight into that process that I feel I now have into the Nebulas.
That's fair.
However, I will say that the moment you get into... no pun intended, vox populi. I think the effect that you're talking about probably ramps up. I think when you're talking about the Nebulas, I'm sure there's a political component, but I mean political, not necessarily in the sense of partisanry. I mean in the sense of people you know, whose work you know. A lot of the cases in the Nebula that I find, and in general, I think in our field, we are putting out so much these days that the chance that anybody is going to have read your work compared to, let's say, the market in the 1970s, and I'm 54, so I was reading and I had some sense of what that was like. It is entirely possible to completely miss either major names in the field in terms of sales, in terms of critical acclaim, in terms of inventiveness. None of these necessarily, you know, overlapping heavily or at all, depending on which bailiwick you find yourself in. And so I think in the Nebulas, you've got, there's to some degree always that idea of not even so much who do you know, but who knows you, just in terms of your work. I can't really speak to the yogas, but I think the moment you put it out to a fan base, I think you're going to get, one, a very honest response in the sense of this will reflect what they feel and what they like and what they believe. On the other hand, it's not coming from the same perspective.
That's fair.
I don't think we should expect the same kind of criteria. I'm not saying that as a positive or a negative. It's just, I don't think it's going to be the same criteria influencing that choice.
Yeah.
So I would not at all take issue. I would not have the temerity even to take issue with your formulation of what probably occurred last night. but was sort of occurring all the way along in my sense, from my perspective. I would just, you know, I got sometimes in trouble being a professor of literature simply because I believe in all the critical apparatuses. But when I was getting my PhD, essentially in the 90s, it was all about isms. And sometimes isms get in the way of ideas and inquiry, particularly when this is my ism and I build my, you know, my ism is my temple. When it comes to me in critical apparatuses or the structures of the methods I use with writing, the end result, whether it's the analysis, whether it is the inquiry into the work or the creation of the work, you use whatever combination of tools you feel does the best job.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think that the critical apparatuses have sometimes very overtly and consciously, attempted to almost abscond with to me, the primacy is in the work. I don't know that the author is dead. I'm not saying that the reader is dead. But I think John Barth was trying to kill one off to bring the Roland Barthes, not John Barth. That's a different number. was trying to kill one off at the expense of the other. And my sense is, I think both are active in the world and always have been.
Sure, sure.
So
yeah,
that's long rambling response, but there you go.
Let's jump to a different topic because obviously we started by talking about the fact that Fire with Fire was nominated, and I know we mentioned very briefly earlier, I think in a walk-by session you came by very briefly, but you have a new book coming out that is essentially a sequel, but it takes a very different focus, I guess you could say.
Yeah. It's safe to say that if Fire with Fire was a book that fundamentally was focused on an individual's experience, and in that walk-by, I think I may have mentioned that if you're going to introduce a world that people are not familiar with, I think to borrow a cinematic metaphor, because I was in television and film before I did this. This is always, by the way, what I wanted to do, but I guess I had that little bit of media prostitute in me, so I'm... I walked that side of the street with my skirts hiked up. But at any rate, one of the things that they are, you know, if you want to understand what a world is like, I wouldn't suggest a Robert Altman approach where, well, Robert Altman has these almost unconnected vignettes in a lot of his films,
okay.
not like MASH, which was more coherent and driven and focused and sort of followed a single arc. But you have these sort of pastiches that almost come together over time like a mosaic, and ultimately all the pieces fall together and give you the picture. A little bit like Crash, but even more dispersed than that. The reason I get into this is just saying that the first one was very much sort of focused on one consciousness. There were multiple point of views, but it was largely filtered through the one because it was a new world to that character, and it would have been a new world to a reader. So that was how I focused on that. The second one is a move in the direction of certainly I would like to think a slightly more serious take on an exosapient quote invasion. Of course, it's not the reason I say quote invasion is because part of what I'm interested in that is the relationship between government and corporation, the fact that and not all corporations are created equally, so to speak.
Sure.
In this case, some which have become, I would say, so besotted with the profit at any cost, by which I mean moral cost, they actually manage to find a way to, if you will, inveigle themselves into a semi. They have a national fig leaf, if you will, in the form of Indonesia. So they have a kind of semi-political presence, and when certain letters of the law are potentially violated or they feel are violated, they invite these exosapiens to come in to help defend their rights. Now, at that moment, are you dealing with collaboration, invasion, simply political alternity? You know, which is it? And so I think one of the things that will be interesting to see is, as my books continue to come out, I'm not saying that any author works in a simple vein, probably some more than others.
Sure.
Given my background, probably I was a member on the council of the Transatlantic Studies Association for 6 years, 5 years, something like that. And I guess you could say some of my academic interests, I would certainly throw out the notion that things sometimes happen in my books perhaps for different reasons than they might happen in other books that might get lumped together in the same section of the shelf. Okay. So it is an alien, quote, an alien invasion story, but I think it will show perhaps some distinctions in that regard.
That's going to be really fascinating. I'm going to buy it. Yes. But it's obviously not out yet. But
oh, yes, it is.
It's
not out here. I signed a bunch at I had a signing at Forbidden Planet on Friday.
Okay.
And signed a bunch there, but they didn't make it here. It's been out in the States since the 3rd of August. It had its first 5-day run. It was number 27 on BookScan.
Okay.
So it's had
I'm going to make a
decent
note right now.
Okay.
Yeah, no, because you're talking about stuff that's right up my alley, mm-hmm. In terms of when it comes to literature and what I look for in science fiction for my academic work.
Yeah,
is those kinds of things, that invasions. Obviously, when you went to the Writing Post-Colonialism panel, those are issues that are really relevant for my work.
By the way, I also noticed that you had a particular interest, and I wondered whether it was purely academic or personal, in the Philippines. And,
I literally just taught a class, on American Empire and Diaspora,
mm-hmm.
as an upper division course, the first upper division course I've ever taught, so it was exciting. And we did cover, a novel from the Philippines and some of the historical, relevance to the Philippines. So it's kind of fresh for me.
My roommate for my first 2 years at undergrad is a Filipino, by the name of Alfredo Ayala. Hi, Freddie, if you're listening, and it was kind of interesting because it also, let's say that post-colonialism and colonialism shows up in all sorts of ways and bleeds into other issues. And one of the things that I find interesting almost about any academic subject, whether it's old classics or whether it's, you know, that great marshy, productive, and yet indistinct wasteland of cultural studies. Wasteland is not the right. It is a productively trackless domain, in the sense that it seems to. It so many things can fit under that umbrella that they do. But one of the, and it's a terrible thing to say, but one of my, in addition to my sense of the Philippines, I'd never visited, which saddens me to this day. 4 kids now makes that quite problematic. But one of the things I remember is I'm not going to tell a long stupid story, but there are two things that I remember in Filipino and Tagalog. One is "Happy birthday" is "Malagayang Arawan," and the other one is "Mukhang Tay," and that means "You look like shit," which actually I use in Trial by Fire, because somebody misidentifies somebody. They see the Micronesian similarity. They say, "Oh, you look like a local." Well, it's not an Indonesian. It's actually a Filipino of a Filipino extraction, American. And he says, "Yeah, well, mukhang tay," you know, and he has to go to the big Swede extraction guy from the Midwest to get the translation. This being an African American individual doing this, so there's a bit of a stew pot there on the wharves in Indonesia in Jakarta. So I have fun with these sort of things.
That's excellent. So sorry,
you're coming to take me away again.
That was a little loud. So obviously, I think it would be fair to say then, based on some of what I know of your work, that these kinds of questions involved in post-colonialism, or colonialism for that matter, certainly are in some ways affecting, or at least you're intentionally bringing some of this in.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, if I would say that no one can politically place me, which is just fine by me. What I mean by that is I'm really more interested in process than isms. I fear extremist politics of any kind. I fear radical politics of any kind, simply because the history of radicalism, whether in the 20th century, shows us whether you're right or left, communist or fascist, the bottom line is the more... There's a real truth in the notion that there's strength in numbers and unity, and Lenin writes What Is to Be Done, which, of course, he picks up the title for Chernyshevsky. So he's working in a utopian or speculative tradition, and he announces the part. Essentially, he creates an ideological star chamber with that. That is the beginning of that. And of course, Hitler and Mussolini do the same thing, a little less intellectual, but it's the same principle. The problem is once you start following the line, once you start setting aside your conscience, but your best cognitive approach to critically assess the things that are being promulgated and you're being asked to take action upon, when you begin suppressing to some degree your own instincts towards questioning, I think things are becoming increasingly dangerous. And in, for instance, when I taught, I don't know what your throw footprint is with your blog, but if you could find any of my students, I'd be interested if any of them knew my politics before I stopped teaching. I don't know if they know him now. Most of the Bain authors can't place me politically either.
An enigma.
because I make noises, I suppose, from both sides of the line. Because okay. I choose, not because I tread both sides of the line, but because I really don't give a damn where the line is.
That's fair.
I think, you know, if we go back to what the notion of the marketplace of ideas that's set forth in the Federalist Papers, I mean, there's a nod towards party politics, but I think when party becomes more important, or when we begin to rationalize, and this is the really dangerous one, our movement away from from consulting with our own, better lights, be they our ethical lights, be they our intellectual lights, we tread dangerously. And it seems to me that whatever else, you know, although there is, like I said, a very, very strong nod to what's going to evolve as party politics in the Federalist Papers, it doesn't mean you put your own common sense second. And that was always why one of the reasons I suppressed, very actively suppressed, any personal opinion about almost anything, even aesthetics, when it came to when I was teaching, was because it struck me that my job was not to promulgate a worldview, but was to promote critical thinking. And there is a natural human social mammal response that this is the person who's handing out the grades. What are they like? It would be great if I liked what they like. You know, I didn't want that. I wanted the quality of the argument. I gave at least as many, if not more, A's for people who, although they did not know it, who were completely at variance with my interpretation of a book or an essay or something like that because of the quality of their argument.
Yeah, that's actually one of the hardest things, I think. I'm a fairly new teacher because I've only...
Where do you teach, by the way?
University of Florida. I'm a grad student there. I got my MA, and I'm getting a PhD now.
I actually taught in Florida for 1 year. I was at Eckerd College over in St. Petersburg.
Okay.
So that was very early in my career. Now, you're Florida in
Gainesville.
Is it Gainesville? Okay, because there are several different campuses, are there not?
There are, like, satellite Florida campuses, but they're usually for the sciences.
Right.
Yeah, we English people don't get to go any cool places.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you get to... I think Joe Haldeman goes to Gainesville. Does he go in the winter, I think? Is it Gainesville?
Well, he's in Gainesville.
Right.
He now just lives there because he just retired from teaching at MIT.
Oh, he's no longer at MIT?
I just saw him retired.
Here, but I didn't hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's been doing it a while.
I'm quite familiar. Yeah, I interviewed Joe up in Boston, I guess 5 years ago.
Oh, wow, okay.
And he's, by the way, also now, I believe he's on the pages. He certainly was approached and said yes to Sigma. So when we get around to that, Joe Haldeman is also, I believe, now
awesome.
A Sigma.
That's great.
A Sigma member, yeah.
But what I was going to say is, as a new teacher, that's actually a very difficult process, is trying to... Even if I'm going to present my view of what a thing is, making sure that is not gospel.
Yeah.
You know, especially when it comes to an interpretation. Like, there are, like, obvious wrong interpretations. Like, if you say Hamlet's about fish, like, that's just, you're wrong. But...
Yes, I would agree with that.
Yeah, but you know, I don't think there should be, like, I can't say, oh, here's my interpretation and that's the gospel, you have to write what I just said. Because that doesn't actually help for something like literary analysis. And that also, of course, applies to, since I am a post-colonial scholar...
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to present a view that is equally as gospel about what is the post-colonial, say, the condition of the post-colony,
right,
et cetera. And I try to present it's hard to, but trying to present somewhat alternate views of that, mm-hmm. but that could be very difficult because postcolonialism has a rhetoric that's already associated with it.
Yeah.
And pushing outside of that can be very difficult. Although there are debates in postcolonialism.
Oh, it seems most yeah. certainly so, yes.
Yeah.
Gayatri Spivak certainly, I think, stood the field on its head in terms of its self-inquiry. And this goes back to, and by the way, just because this is a purely audio media, what folks at home can't know is that I'm sitting here nodding my head like a bobblehead through a lot of this, which is a really gruesome image, but I'll ask you to go with it anyhow. But one of the things about post-colonialism or structuralism or deconstruction or any of these things is that, and it's one of the things that I sort of feel that I would, had I stayed in academia, I would have liked to have challenged the academy with the notion of reconstructionism, which sounds like it's a Civil War thing, and it isn't. But in the sense that since really probably New Criticism, since the university enterprise became increasingly, quite frankly, commercialized, there has been, the Rice Bowl's gotten bigger. And not surprisingly, the Rice Bowl got bigger and everybody started charting turf. And I think turf wars really became far more codified. They were always there, but they became really codified. And it strikes me that one of the things, what Reconstruction is about mentally for me, is I guess, and it's my own stuff, which is use any of these tools. But the notion is if we're well trained, part of our training should be, and I think really is, knowing which tool is going to be best for which analysis. Now, of course, there's a problem there that you could drive a Mack truck through, the hole in that, which is, well, then, are you choosing the... See, they're coming to take me away again because I'm saying way too provocative things here. The Academy is coming now. This is what happens when you renounce tenure. You get taken away.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, that was... Now that I admitted that, they're leaving. But the thing is, the danger, of course, is if you are... It's always the danger of rationalization, I think. Are you using the methods you're using because you've looked at the question, you've looked at the tools, and you've paired them up in the most reasonable, productive fashion that you can think, or is rationalization of what you prefer, the ends you'd like to see, is sort of an academic equivalent of the Heisenberg, the observer effect, creeping in, and you're choosing the lab in which you're conducting the test to get results that you'd really like to see. And I think it would be really interesting if criticism moves more to the side of not so much, well, this was not deconstructionist, or this person was wrong about their application of that, versus when they went to the golf bag of which clubs to use, what do I think of the clubs they used? Were they really the right clubs for this enterprise? Because it seems to me, a lot of my, for instance, going back to ancient history now, a lot of my dissertation, probably the single largest person, critically speaking, was Raymond Williams.
Okay.
And actually, I think Raymond Williams, in my mind, has a lot to say to colonial and post-colonial studies simply because he became, in things like problems of material and culture, Marxism and literature, things like that, he becomes very interested in hegemony and goes back, and I think he uses, I don't know if you're, I'm sure you are, Gramsci's sort of reconstruction of the dialectic process, where instead of going to thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And I think this is a really interesting model for what's going on today in the United States and possibly all over the world. He talks about three movements present at any time in society: the dominant, the residual, and the emergent.
Oh, interesting.
And this goes all the way back to Gramsci. So we're going back to the 1930s. And Raymond Williams brings that around and directly infuses that into his model of hegemony. And so we're sitting in the post-colonial thing yesterday, and that's where that's the source of that question that I asked.
Okay.
About, we talk about stuff that's post-colonial. Yep, absolutely. And there is something very particularly post-colonial with the things that go on from Eurogenic colonization forward. And one of the reasons I think that is, and how I think going back and borrowing Williams and putting him back in the discussion, is because he's really talking about power. He's talking about hegemony. But the methodologies of hegemony change. Because sometimes pluralism is rising up as an increasingly emergent, but eventually, hopefully, dominant notion, to use Gramsci's apparatus, in the West, you see this interesting change in how power is projected, which is the Roman Empire, for instance, just to go back, old style, imperial, truly imperial, in that we don't care what language you speak here. You pay tribute, you don't give us guff, and we largely leave you alone. But it's essentially, to use an Aramaic term, it's bakshish. You'll pay us because we're the it's a big sort of big protection racket when you get right down to it. It's mafia.
It's true.
It really is. You know, because it's remarkable how hands off the Romans were. I mean, you know, this goes all the way back to strange sort of, and talk about flying far afield now. When you go back to looking at I can't think of the term for exegesis. You know, people are, they make a big deal out of what Pilate did, for instance, regarding Christ. Yeah. Okay. By the way, I'm a hopeful agnostic, just so you understand, there is not a separate thread that's about to creep its way into this discussion. But it is absolutely not surprising what Pilate does. Pilate is actually pretty much following provincial notions, unless Christ or anybody else represents a threat to Roman authority. Not my business, man. Your local stuff is your local stuff, which is largely how they kept from constantly having revolts. They kept their noses out as much as they could. Enter, of course, the age of pluralism, the Enlightenment, you know, what historians call the early modern age, although people in literary studies think that happens like 300 years later, because we associate that with modernism. But in that sort of 1550s, 1630s, particularly when the Dutch are getting involved, and it's not just a Spanish pool anymore, but colonialism is really moving into... It's importing. You know, you talk about what colonialism, post-colonialism imports.
And this is the section where we jumped forward because of too much noise and we jumped to a different location. So hopefully it's not too jarring, but in any case, here's the second half.
Okay, so picking up on the riveting subject of hegemony, Gramscian, Marxian revisitation and post-colonialism, because that's what you all tuned in for, is just that I think one of the things about one of the things I was saying that it would be interesting to see post-colonialism look at, and I haven't. It's maybe because I've been out of the game for a number of years, but it seems to me that much of Europe, particularly in the latter part of that entire eugenic colonial enterprise, was so caught up in its own issues of increasing pluralism and participatory nature of government. That to some degree that begins to influence what they're importing along with their colonialism. Was it a bunch of individuals sitting down and sitting around the table and saying, we must make schools? We must, you know, why was language control so important? Why was building schools and infrastructure so important? It had not been important to the Romans. It had not been important historically to the Chinese in their own expansion in many of the same areas. But all of a sudden, right as these issues are becoming, if you will, the sine qua non of social progress in the West in its colonial action imports those expectations along with it into the rest of the world and gives themselves, in my opinion, a heck of a problem.
Yeah.
Because in a sense, the thing about Roman imperialism is it had one horrible virtue. It was naked aggression and oppression. And in that, in a sense, it was very easy to understand because it was binary. And your value, if you were a subject people, was to the Roman state. And they could tell you what it was, and they really did not care about your soul or your gods or your this or your that. They wanted tribute, they wanted levies and auxiliaries if they asked for them, and that was it. It was a business deal. Are you late with your payment? Do we have to break your kneecaps?
As you said, a mafia.
Pretty much, with kind of really interesting looking hats. But now you get into the 1700s, and you have a huge sort of divided consciousness, I think, in the colonizers themselves.
Yeah.
You didn't have many Romans running around saying, genuinely, but we should build schools. But we should, you know, now the arrogances of, is our medicine better than yours? Is our language better than yours? Is our literature better than yours? When they didn't even bother to read very often local traditions, which were five times as old and three times as complex.
Sure.
Let's leave that aside for a second. Because what I'm really getting at is what is in people's hearts and their intents. And a lot of colonialism didn't even have the virtue of naked aggression. It was some people concealed it knowingly. I think a lot of it was rationalized.
Oh yeah, certainly.
Which in some ways is dangerous, because how do you get your handle on that, which is justified by rationalization? And then some of it was very genuine, working, you know, well, actually, we do want to promote education, and our arrival here has maybe, to some degree, disfigured and destroyed the whatever the local systems were. It's beholden upon us to put something back in. From the standpoint of the colonizer, you look at it, it's like, okay, well, the Romans were here, and they were, you know, monomaniacal brutes, but these people are schizophrenic. Whoever you're talking to tells you something different, and they all believe it.
Yeah.
That's very difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing about colonization and imperialism is the way in which it actually evolves over time,
the
rhetoric that surrounds it. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with this, but people listening
marginally,
may not be.
Marginally.
I mean, you take something like the British Empire and, say, the French and Spanish empires. I shouldn't speak about the Spanish, actually. I don't know enough about them. But, you know, this initial rhetoric of we're going to Africa and we're colonizing, we're going to have slaves, all of this stuff. But we view them as inferior people who are incapable of governance anyway. They're like giant children who deserve to be treated like animals. But then you get the later period, say, like the British in India, where they actually believe, to some extent, at least in self-governance, maybe out of necessity, because maybe it's a little difficult to be trying to rule the world. And the United States and the Philippines is a great example. It's often defined as benevolent despotism, because we sort of waltz in and we say, we're not going to be like the Spanish. We're going to be these great people, and we think you're fully capable of being able to govern yourselves. But not right now. You're inferior as a culture and a people, but we'll get there. And we'll teach you. We'll teach you, and you'll be great. You'll be fine. But those things change over time, and they become like what Homi Bhabha talks about, the rhetoric as being ambiguous and in some cases hypocritical or sort of counteracting itself, because you get this rhetoric of who is inside and outside. And so when we're saying that the colonizer, you're not like us, but we wanted to make you like us, but you can never be like us while we're trying to make you like us, and this sort of circular argument that sort of arises out of that. It's really, I think, quite fascinating to look at that.
Well, it is. And I think one of the difficulties is, as we discover with discourse in general, discourse is usually uttered as though it is controllable. And fundamentally, it is not. Take a look at just, you know, ethnic and race naming and nomenclature in the United States. The history of it from, let's say, 1940 to, let's say, 2010. And you have in many different groups articulated changes of what the desired nomenclature should be. But inside the group itself, whatever that group is, however you define it, however they define themselves, this is already problematic. And then you have certain distinctions as to what's appropriate. I don't have to go back to for instance, when Chris Rock decided to drop the N-bomb in his act, and this goes back, I guess, to 2003, 2004,
Yeah.
Creates a huge flap. And if anything, points to the fact that we look for single authorities in discourse, in that discourse, and the problem is, discourse is inherently not centralizable. And the more you try to control it, the less you have discourse and the more you have propaganda.
Yeah.
And so there's, I think, the entire... You know, this is one of the reasons I brought up the topic I did, and I don't want to say that this is foregrounded in my novels, because, quite frankly, I think if you tried to foreground this in a novel, there might be an audience for it, but I think it would be a limited audience, and that limited audience, now we get into, again, the centralization of discourse on an entirely different level. I resigned my teaching position in 2007. I haven't been in a classroom since. I think the last conference work I did was in 2009. I think it was in Poland. Szczecin. And I was there, I think, got a Fulbright travel grant. I've had three full Fulbrights and two and a half, three Fulbright travel grants. And the thing is that once I drop, now we're getting away to, again, how exigencies push discourse. I'm not saying that I'm dying to write a novel that essentially reprises this conversation in its totality, because I think I'd miss the action sequences. Because you can be fair, I'm hoping that you're not going to suddenly, this isn't going to turn into a slasher flick, and Sean Duke isn't going to lean across the table and you know, stick a chair leg through my chest or something. But sometimes that sells fiction. You know, at least it sells cheesy movies. But my point is that when you're writing full time, quite frankly, entertainment does begin to really ask serious questions of art and how you get something across and what your objectives are. You can choose not to allow them to be informed by the new domain in which you find yourself, but you do so at your peril. And you do so with the possibility of, right now I have 5 books out, I've got contracts for another 5. Oh, wow. If I was writing, and that's one of the great things, by the way, about working for Bain, which we can talk about later on as you like. But the thing is, I have 4 kids. It's an income component for me. It's how I survive. Like I say, you can ignore the market, but you do so at your peril. And then once you're a dad, you do so with the peril of more than just yourself.
Sure.
But all that being said, I actually believe that if you can bind... I'm not so much interested in taking a platform as, I guess, doing what I did when I was a creative writing teacher or professor, which was, please think about these things. I'm not drawing any conclusions for you, but please think about these things, because they're worth thinking about. I feel very few things so certainly in my life that I would be willing to stand up and say, here is the position I take on this topic, because... time changes things, perspective changes things. The Koreans have that saying, we see from where we sit, and I only sit where I sit. So I'm hesitant to say, let me tell you how it is. I can only tell you how it is from where I'm sitting.
Yeah, yeah.
If I'm playing the game by the rules. So when these things filter into my fiction, they are more, I would say, in the setup than they are in the resolution. They create problems that don't necessarily get resolved. And the problem that I think is motivating me a lot in these first 2 books is I am sometimes distressed with what I would call the implicit excessive reification or condensation of thought around certain belief systems, for instance. In the market system, there's a notion that's, which I guess is frequently, for instance, connected with Ayn Rand, about just back up and everything will take care of itself. That sounds a little bit absolute to me. There may be some truths into the fact...
Sorry. Yep.
Yep. That's Ayn Rand, just flying over and shutting me up. Damn you, Ayn Rand. I think... for sure, market forces, human desire for material goods, for realization through work or possession, etc. This is pretty much observed around the world. There are a couple of, you know, Micronesian. There are a couple of very, very small indigenous peoples where possession and dwelling is radically different from most of the rest of the world. But it's fascinating how, no matter where you go, whatever the linguistic differences are, cities occur. Specialization occurs. And with specialization comes concentration of power. Concentration of power has certain identifiable features which are reprised again and again and again on small and large scale. So here's the truth of human nature. On the other hand, there are some truths to, I think, at the very core, I want to say deep down, in the sense of kind of distant from a lot of the superficial rhetoric of the notion of market and power and the reality of that. There's certainly also, but the thing is, it can go too far. When it gets to the point where it's that and nothing else, then I begin to scratch my head. And on the other hand, then you have the notion that somehow, I really like John Lennon's, exhortation, give peace a chance. But it's never been that simple.
No.
And the utopian project usually has a sort of an inverse but very similar issue with the sort of what I'm going to call the Ayn Rand absolute, which is they're both building a bridge from where we are to some other place.
That doesn't exist.
The other place seems to exist very well in their mind. What we never see is the bridge.
Yeah.
It's that tricky business.
Yeah.
Of getting from where we are to this sort of idealized view. I cite my fiction purposefully 100 years ahead in a situation where humanity is challenged to survive by learning how to work together better on the bridge.
Interesting.
It's there for a very, very definitive reason. And there's a lot of action adventure and et cetera, et cetera. But I would ask anybody to to stop flying planes overhead.
Wow. Two within a couple minutes of each other.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Uh-huh. You get them. So it gives me a lot of fun with this, because since I don't propose to have an answer for this.
Sure.
If I did, I'd be doing a disservice pursuing the career I am. I would also have an incredibly unrealistic opinion of myself and the world. I think we will come to the answers with many, many failures, many iterations, through many swings of the pendulum to either side of any possible polarization, political or cultural, you want to name. But hopefully we will continue to make progress in that direction. I just want to cite my stories in what I would call the extended moment of fulcrum discourse. Hmm. And then I have fun with it, because if the stories and the characters are engaging and there's suspense and there's a mystery and it asks some cosmological questions and origin questions, I don't want to make this sound like Mary Poppins in the sense, you know, a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down, but because to me, that's not really what I'm doing. All of these things interest me.
Sure.
I was in film because I think film is fun, and I love editing, and my action sequences tend to be a lot of cut-on action. They get shorter, the sentences get shorter, because if you, for instance, look at the way film editing goes, you may have long pans, but when you get into a fight scene, the average per-shot time begins to decrease. Classical cut-on action picks up because you need very fast orientation. You can't have anything new introduced inside that because it slows the moment down. So I like that component of my job too, which might be perceived by some folks who live in the lofty as a full-time thing, shall we say, very, very pedestrian. But you know what? My feeling is I like French fries. And I like escargot. Why can't I like both?
You can.
Right. So I do. And
same with literature.
Yeah, exactly right. And I will be, I suppose, radical enough to put them both in the same book if I can fit them in.
So you basically are implying that you want to have French fries and escargot as part of the same dish.
In the same restaurant, let's say. The gastronomy of a single moment of jamming a snail and a cubed potato into my mouth and within seconds of each other. I don't know. I'm having a problem with that image myself. So next question, please.
Because we're almost to 11 o'clock, so I did want to take us a brief moment to have you talk about Bane, actually.
Okay.
Because you're the first Bane author. Never had anyone from Bane on this show.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your experience with, I mean, obviously it's a positive experience because you have like a 900 book deal with them.
No. Larry Correa might, but I don't. but I'm not complaining.
No, I hope not. So what has your experience been like with Bane?
That's a hard thing. Well, that's either a very long answer that is presuming a subtext set of questions, or a very short answer that just answers that question on the surface, which is, and I'll start there, and I'll let you tell me what subtext you might want. But it's been a great experience. It's a fairly light editorial hand for me, but a very, very canny one, I think. If you look in the books and you see the stuff that's left in there, I mean, you know, the mere fact of the matter is that my feeling about Bane, when you get right down to it, is that, and I'm not sure they're, how can I say this? I think Tony Weisskopf, the publisher and editor, knows her market very well. I think she's right about, for instance, the covers that sell. I don't know that those covers are necessarily always... I'm not sure that the covers reflect the diversity of work. I think what they do is they reflect a definable core audience set of tastes. Okay. But those tastes, in terms of what they are actually interested in literature, are perhaps more diverse than what the branding would suggest. Notice I started by saying that I don't think the branding is unwise, because in the realm of commerce, if you don't bring in the dollars, you don't stay in business.
Sure, sure.
But to me, it is that diversity is not a mistake and it's not a fluke, simply because the lightness of the editorial touch, not merely in terms of narrative quality, but the topics you deal with, the political stances taken. I mean, as you're probably aware, Eric Flint, self-avowed Marxist, union worker. If you read the 1632 series, particularly the first book, you're going to see something that definitely works against, I think, what is probably now the slightly more publicized. There are potentially, I guess you could say, there are certain voices which have been more associated because of their prevalence in terms of, I guess, what's been provocative recently.
Sure.
With Bain. And I think that's a case of people judging a very, very complex set of encyclopedias by the cover of one or two of the volumes.
Sure, sure.
And that's, you know, that's, and the politics of the people inside Bain are very different. But from my perspective, they don't really change much of what goes on in-house at all.
Okay.
So in that regard, it's an incredibly liberating experience in a lot of ways. A whole lot more liberating than working in academia, I'll tell you that much. Just having the opportunity, one of the things about Bain, for instance, is that unlike a lot of publishers who answer very, very closely to a large corporate structure, because there's a lot of autonomy at the top in Bain. This means that my first contracts were done as a handshake with Tony, and they were, that handshake, sure, word is their bond. And, you know, publishing anything, TV, I know about TV, you find a place where that's the case. And that's a really reassuring environment in which to work. And that's kind of an ethos that spans, as I look at the Bain authors, that's something that really spans across them regardless of whatever their different cultural origins, political opinions, behavior at a party might be. That these are a lot of business on a handshake people. Word is my bond, and I have a deep, deep appreciation for that. Like I said, a lot of freedom to work, a lot of support for series. You hear about what's called the death spiral of the trilogy. You know, the 70% sell-through, which turns into, well, we're only going to produce 70% of the books we published last time, and again and again and again, and somehow, despite the fact you're hitting the industry standard of real strong success at 70% sell-through, by the time you are in your second book, you're printing 49%, you know, your numbers. And this is probably not a good thing. And that is not what happens at Bain. So if you, like me, I'm very much involved in world building. That comes from my work with game writing and a variety of other things, where I tend to tell stories in a long arc. My concept, for instance, is for this entire series that I'm working with now, Fire with Fire, Trial by Fire, the next one is probably going to be titled, this is Raising Cain, is really when I sat down and I'd been working on the background for about 15 years. And each story, whether it's a novel or a piece of shorter fiction, I have always visualized as a tile in a mosaic. And the bigger picture will become more evident as more tiles accumulate. And this is sort of my way. I think there are some issues which are simply too big to throw into a book simply because... You know, there's some things you can only study with time-lapse photography. There's some, okay. I think there are certain social conditions which are like that as well.
Fair. Well, we're basically at the, we got to stop.
And that's
sad.
No, probably a relief for you and your listeners too.
So really quick, so folks will know where to find you. Where can they go? Well, A, hunt down your internet presence and your books.
My internet presence, I do have a website called, what a shocker, be prepared to copy down this completely non-intuitive website, www.charlesegannon.com. same name as on the books, obviously. So you can find me there. For folks who are interested in any of my work, I've made sure it's all available in one place. Not the academic stuff, although you can find links to it. There's a lot of stuff still online. I've done a whole bunch of collaborations, so all the stuff that I do with Eric Flint, you can find links to it there. My own stuff, the Tales of the Terran Republic, you can find that there, plus probably, I think it's about 60,000 words of bonus content online. I believe in value added. Obviously Barnes & Noble and Amazon, and just as a matter of fact, in the last few days, both of the books in the Fire with Fire and Trial by Fire are now available as audiobook as well.
Nice.
So that's where I am. You'll probably want to learn how to avoid me, rather than in the sense that I'm all over the place. So it's like, oh, that guy again. I do not blog. For reasons simply because with four kids, I made a decision that Facebook, I can cross post. I get the first line of any Facebook post cross posted onto Twitter, so that works. Blogs, I feel you need to have something. To want to do it, I want to do it well, and I want to have something of strong substance to say. You have to do it regularly, and quite frankly, I look at that and I say, yeah, but I could be putting another 10,000 words towards a novel or a story instead of the other thing. So Facebook is where I go. It sits astride, I think, the sort of spectrum of social media. So that's the one that I've chosen. And this is a much bigger answer than the simple question you asked. But trim it out. Sean, thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
And thank you very much. And thanks for, we keep missing each other and finally got to make it work. So
great.
Awesome. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.